Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents War Song by B.R. Kingsolver. Narrated by Rachel DeLude. Chapter 1.
Everyone's in place,
the voice over my radio said.
We go at 60.
60 seconds before a force of Metropolitan Police and Guardians from half a dozen Magi families stormed the block-long warehouse, housing Lucifer's Lair, the most notorious nightclub in the Mid-Atlantic. I did a last-second mental check of my weapons and armor. Since I knew the inside layout better than almost anyone, I would be in the second wave, following the assault teams who would breach the entrances and secure the building. We had no idea how many demons were in the building. We only knew that the listed owner, the Demon Lord Ashvile, was dead. Most of the force were there to capture or kill the demons inside, but my primary mission was to take control of the computer systems, paper files, and the human employees who managed Ashvile's finances. Of course, that was all located in a part of the building I'd never seen.
Go!
Aeromancers used battering rams of compressed air to blow the front doors open. Bolts of lightning crashed against the doorframe, shorting out any electronic defenses. And then heavily armored men rushed into the building. The sound of large-caliber automatic weapons echoed inside, diminishing to occasional shots, the crackle of lightning, and the whoosh of fireballs. From where I was standing outside, the interior of the building looked as though a fireworks show was going on inside. When things quieted a little, I led my small team in and took an immediate right toward a door in the wall opposite the bar. We crossed the large room without any resistance, although I noted the bodies of three demons. I didn't expect many of them to be downstairs in the middle of the day. Most of them would be on the third floor, where the red light was more welcoming to their eyes. The door had an electronic keypad, and I sent a spell into it. The door clicked, and I cast another spell into the room beyond to disable any nasty anti-intrusion devices that might be installed there. Normally, the business offices would have been full of workers on a Wednesday, but our surveillance indicated that only a few employees had entered the building that morning. As a cop, I was paid to have a suspicious mind, and my guess was the humans in charge of the business operation had figured out Ashvile wasn't coming back. And if it were me, I'd be working overtime to loot the assets and destroy any evidence the authorities might use to connect me to Ashvile's illicit activities. In their own world, demons didn't use money the way humans did. And as far as computers and technology were concerned, they were total idiots. They just couldn't wrap their minds around physics and chemistry performing tasks that demons did with magic. Sure enough, the reception desk was unmanned, and the cubes in the large room beyond were all empty. That meant any people who were present would be in the offices lining the outside walls of the building. I sent my team to capture anyone they found while I headed toward the computer room. The plans on file with the building commission showed me where I needed to go. A spell disabled the keypad on the door, and I slipped inside. One man sat at a console with his back to me.
Don't even think about touching that keyboard again,
I said in my sweetest, gentlest voice, placing the muzzle of my Raider 50 against his skull. Put your hands in the air, or I'll blow your head off. It was rather gratifying how quickly he obeyed. Now, stand up and walk toward the wall to your left, I said. Again, he obeyed. I followed him, handcuffed him, then made him sit down against the wall. A pair of ankle shackles made sure he wouldn't run away. I put a small silver-colored box on the floor a few feet in front of him. That's a Magitek box, I said. If you move to either side or attempt to stand up, it will electrocute you. Do you understand? He nodded enthusiastically, but managed to ask in an aggrieved tone.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Lieutenant Danica James, Metropolitan Police, and this is a raid.
The way his eyes widened told me that he was far more upset that I was a police officer than he would have been if I were a fellow crook. I sat down at the console and, using my cranial implant, jacked into the computer system. The first thing I checked was what my captive had been doing. Then I patted myself on the back. He had been transferring funds from one of Ashvile's bank accounts into a private account in Switzerland, and I was willing to bet it was a personal account that he owned. He wasn't shy, either. The transfer was set up to move $90 million. I immediately stopped the transfer and changed the passwords to both accounts. Then I accessed the rest of Ashvile's accounts and did the same thing. After changing the passwords to the internal computer system, I locked the console and pulled my consciousness back into the real world. I would give the new access codes to the police's forensic accountants and let them take care of the detail work. I dragged my captive out of the soundproofed computer room and into the noise of the raid. Gunshots and the sounds of magical weapons came from overhead, along with the snarls, roars, and screams of demons. I was still sore from my last fight with a demon, so I gladly turned away from the stairs. I hauled the computer genius out the door to a waiting paddy wagon and accepted a cup of coffee from a cop standing there. We discussed the weather for a while until all the noise inside stopped. Then I went back in to supervise the arrest of the other humans and the cataloging of Ashvile's business records. When I got the final tally of demons captured and killed, the numbers seemed small compared to how many I'd seen on my previous visits there. I figured some had escaped, and some had probably decided to find other living arrangements after Ashvile died. I did go up to his office on the second floor. I grabbed a couple of newbie detectives and took them with me. There weren't too many humans who read demon, and most of them worked in research institutions, not for the police. When I walked in, the first thing I noticed was the statuette. I was a little surprised it was still there. The body of a woman, a human woman, with the head of a dragon. Sharp ridges ran from the top of her head between her horns, down her back, to the tip of her tail, which was curled around her feet. She looked almost alive, as though her skin would be soft and warm. Her eyes were demon red, glowing, and just as when I'd seen her before, I felt as though they followed me. I pulled out my phone and called Kevin Goodman, head of the Arcane Forensics Branch. "Kevin, remember that house up by Pimlico, the drug house where the demons were massacred? Can you send the magic detector who was at the house that day over to Lucifer's lair? I have something I want her to look at." After I hung up, one of the detectives with me said, "That thing isn't alive, is it? I feel like it's watching me." "Yeah, I don't know, but don't touch it." I started going through the papers in Ashvile's desk and filing cabinets, handing them to the detectives with instructions on how to catalog them. We'd been at it for about an hour when Kevin's magic detector appeared at the door. "Lieutenant James, you wanted to see me." "Yeah, take a look at that." I pointed to the statue. She sucked air, then cautiously approached it. I watched the young mage lick her lips, then extend her arm. She stopped with her hand a few inches away from the statue, held it there for a minute, then pulled her hand close to her body and tucked it between her breast and armpit. "Well?" I asked. "That's it," she said. "That's the magic I felt at the demon house that day." I took a deep breath. "I had a feeling. I think we just closed that case, thanks. What are you going to do with it?" "Now that's a question, isn't it? Ward it and transport it out of here?" "Good luck," she said, backing out of the room without taking her eyes off the statue.
"Danny, wake up. It's happened again."
I felt like I had just fallen asleep and I was deep in a dream. "Danny, come on." Kirsten grabbed my shoulder and shook me. I cracked an eye, and sure enough, it was still dark. Well, maybe a little light shone through my bedroom window.
"Is the world coming to an end?" I muttered. "Maybe. Damn it, get the hell up!"
She took hold of my arm and literally dragged me out of bed and into the kitchen, where we had a large screen hooked to the data net. The picture of the screen was of the Palace of Commerce in downtown Baltimore shortly after it was bombed. "What about it?" I asked, trying to pick up what the commentator was saying.
"That's not Baltimore," Kirsten said. "It's Prague, this morning."
At that point, I woke up and started listening to the announcer. "Human Liberation Army, HLA, called media outlets and claimed responsibility for the bombing. Their website has a manifesto with a list of demands, and it threatens more mayhem to come. At this point, authorities have said nothing about casualties, but the bomb went off at 10 o'clock in the morning local time, when the building is usually full of people." There were four different palaces of commerce, all tied together with a common computer system. The one in Baltimore had been destroyed a couple of weeks before, so only the ones in Buenos Aires and Nanking remained. All except the one in Nanking were built from the same set of plans, the buildings nearly identical.
"I thought you said that the Akiyama family and Ashvile were responsible for the bombing here in Baltimore," Kirsten said.
"That's what all the big families and their intelligence services seem to think," I answered. "No one has claimed responsibility for that, and the riots stopped when Ashvile died." Not only had the riots stopped in the Mid-Atlantic, but also in Pittsburgh, Atlanta, Charlotte, Detroit, and Kansas City. They continued in Vancouver, Dallas, and Mexico City, all cities under the influence of different demon lords.
"I knew some HLA people at Cambridge," Kirsten said. "Just a bunch of socialist idealists. I can't imagine any of them committing mass murder."
I had never paid much attention to the HLA. I knew they opposed rifters, especially demons, as well as magic users and the magical hierarchy that controlled most of the world's wealth and resources. I grabbed a keyboard and tried to check out their website, but got an error. Kirsten looked over my shoulder.
"What does that mean?"
"Either the amount of traffic crashed their server, or the authorities took it down," I said. Chapter 2. I spent the early part of the morning interrogating Ashvile's business manager. Of course, he denied knowing anything about illegal activities, as though I would believe him. The number of demons in Earth's realm who were not involved in something illegal numbered zero. If you worked for a demon, you had to know your paycheck was being generated from some kind of crime. My previous investigations had revealed that Ashvile was involved with the Akiyama family, who were based in Japan and China. We found records of extensive phone calls and emails between Ashvile and Akiyama. Since demons didn't use telephones or computers, some human had to be Ashvile's proxy, and I wasn't buying the business manager's denials.
"I swear I was under the demon's influence," he said for the dozenth time. "I'm not responsible for anything he did."
With a shrug, I said, "Okay, you stick to your story, and I'm sure the judge won't sentence you to more than 50 years. We take a very dim view of human trafficking, and your approval on those invoices is all I need to convict you." I started packing up all the paper I had brought with me to the interrogation room. "Too bad. If you cooperated, I'm sure I could get that sentence cut in half, but there's no way you're getting off. I've never been to Antarctica, but I hear the prison in the Yukon is a lot nicer, at least in the summer." We had found the evidence that Ashvile was moving huge quantities of rifter drugs in addition to trafficking thousands of human beings. The boys in the missing persons unit in the basement of the police station were going to clear a large portion of their cases due to the business manager's meticulous records. As I stood, the business manager broke. When he started talking, I sent a summons to my partner, Michael Novak, to come in and supervise the man's confession. I had a different but related investigation to attend to. I grabbed my motorcycle and rode out to the Finlay estate north of the city. A few weeks before, my boss, Deputy Police Commissioner Thomas Whitaker, had assigned me to look into the disappearance of a friend's daughter. In doing so, I had uncovered evidence that Martin Johansson, head of one of the 100 most powerful magical families, was involved in the human trade, and that one of his partners was the demon lord Ashvile. At the same time, my granduncle George Finlay had a heart attack, which brought up the question as to who would succeed him as the family head if he died. Shortly thereafter, magical attacks were launched against me and my grandmother, Olivia Finlay James. Then evidence surfaced that David Moncrief, the husband of one of my aunts, Courtney Finlay Moncrief, was a business partner with both Johansson and Ashvile, as well as the Akiyama family. Johansson was murdered. Then Sarah Benning, the missing girl, was discovered at the Moncrief estate. A group of families raided the estate and found other trafficked humans. We also captured Akiyama Hiroku, the security chief of the Akiyama family, who was in the process of trying to smuggle underage girls to Japan. The Moncrief family members at the estate had been rounded up. My Aunt Courtney and her daughters were being kept in protective custody at the Finlay estate, while David was under house arrest at the Moncrief estate. Hiroku was being kept at the estate of Deputy Police Commissioner Thomas Whitaker under tight guard. My objective in going out to Findlay was a personal one, to interview my cousin Carolyn Moncrief and ask her why she paid someone to kill me. Osiris Dillon, the Findlay chief of security, had outfitted a parlor in the west wing of the mansion for use as an interrogation room. It still looked like an elegant parlor, but Magitek devices were implanted in the walls and the ceiling to record visual, audio, and telemetric data. A corner of the room had been partially walled off to hide a truthsayer who watched the proceedings. I sat in a comfortable chair and waited for Carolyn to arrive. By design, the only place for her to sit was an uncomfortable chair across a coffee table from me. When Carolyn entered the room, she looked around, sneered at me, then sauntered over and dropped into the chair. Her long chestnut hair fell across her shoulders, framing a face that should have been lovely but had too many hard planes. Her pale brown eyes were habitually narrowed due to her usually frowning expression. Carolyn was tall, not as tall as me, but several inches taller than her mother, and had her mother's curves. She dressed in the latest fashions that showed a lot of skin. We had known each other for our entire lives, gone to school together, and loathed each other with a fierce passion. "Hello, cousin," she said. "Are you here to give me the third degree?" "What makes you think that?" I asked. "I'm just here to get your statement for the tribunal." Mention of a tribunal, a court of the Magi, caused her frown to deepen. The Moncrief family was among the hundred, and my Aunt Courtney was a Finlay, one of the ten. They were virtually immune from civil authorities, but not from judgment by their peers. "As I'm sure you know," I began, 23 humans that were being held against their will were discovered at the Moncrief estate at Elknest. 17 of them were domestic servants who worked 12 to 14 hours a day, weren't being paid, and weren't allowed to leave. Since you've lived at the estate all your life, I was hoping you could tell me about that. Carolyn stared at me, and I was sure she entertained thoughts of murder, but eventually she said, "I don't know anything about the servants. You'd have to speak to my mother about them." Not her father, curious that she'd throw her dear old mom under the bus. "All right, I will. Now, the other six people we found, one of them told us that he was assigned to you and his duties included activities of a sexual nature. I had seen the guy, and he was gorgeous, not to mention having a body that would cause almost any woman to drool." She snorted. "In his dreams. He's just a pool boy, and he had some fantasy that he was my personal servant. Follows me around, gets underfoot. You know how the underclasses are, lying and thieving. You can't trust any of them." "I see. And what can you tell me about Sarah Benning and the other two girls we found, the empathic projectors, the mage girls?" Carolyn shrugged. "I didn't pay any attention to them. I assumed they were playthings for Hiroku, or maybe some of the other men. I don't play with girls, and I mind my own business." The direct way she said that while staring straight into my eyes let me know that she thought I should mind my own business, too. But you know that the men were playing with them. Sexual games, I asked. Another shrug.
I said I assumed. I don't know for a fact and didn't care to find out.
Okay. Now, on the night of Cousin Lila's betrothal ball, just before the demon started killing people, you abruptly left the room. It looks on the vids as though you knew what was going to happen. Would you care to explain?
No. I see. So it was a complete coincidence that your father and sister left the room, you left the room, and your mother and Carl Rudolph went upstairs to shag, leaving no one in your family in danger of a homicidal demon?
I finally had her attention. Her eyes popped open, and she sat up straight in her chair.
What? Who told you Mom is screwing Carl? It's a lie.
Oh, well, I guess they could have spent an hour and a half in that bedroom playing chess, but based on entries in your mother's diary and their phone records, my bet is they were having sex. Of course, there aren't any CCTV cameras in the bedrooms, just in the hallways. I was lying through my teeth about part of that. We hadn't been able to crack the ward on Aunt Courtney's diary. Her face turned an ugly shade of red, rather splotchy, and I fingered the Magitek cube in my pocket. If she exploded, I had better be quick to trigger a shield. I knew I couldn't match her magic. I thought that was why you were screwing him, I said. The allure of doing your mom's boyfriend. She called me several names that weren't very flattering. But what I really want to know, I said, is why you paid Jessid to kill me. Her demeanor changed completely.
What? Who? Don't flatter yourself, you stupid bitch. I never even think about you. Why would I waste my time and money to kill you?
I held up the page of floral-scented notepaper with my address written on it. Isn't this your handwriting? And your DNA and fingerprints are on the paper.
Yeah, I wrote it, so what?
And why would you be writing my address for someone?
Mom asked if I knew your address. I looked it up for her. She said she wanted to send you something. I might have hoped it was something poisonous, but I didn't ask.
I wasn't a truthsayer, but I'd been a cop for 12 years, and I believed her. Shortly afterward, I let her go back to her room. I wondered what she and her mother would talk about over dinner that evening.
She was telling the truth,
the truthsayer said, as she came out of her hiding place. She chuckled.
The only lie she told was about the pool boy.
Yeah, that was my impression also. So it really was Aunt Courtney Findlay Moncrief who wanted me and my grandmother dead. The world made sense again. I dodged Osiris, going out the kitchen door to collect my bike. I didn't want to talk to him or my grandmother until I had some time to think through the ramifications of Carolyn's admissions. Chapter 3. One of the things that trips a lot of criminals up is falling into habits, developing conscious or unconscious patterns of behavior. Something works, so they do it again. When it works again, they get comfortable with it. The outside door from the kitchen led to a short walkway that branched. Turn right, and it took you to the dumpsters, discreetly hidden inside a tall fence. Turn left, and it led to the driveway that delivery trucks used to bring in the groceries. Past that driveway, another walkway took me to a pleasant little grassy area with a gazebo furnished with a small table and four chairs, and surrounded by trees. Unless the weather was bad, or my expected stay was fairly long, I parked my bike there because it was much closer than the garages. I turned into that miniature park and discovered my granduncle George sitting there. It wasn't a coincidence because he wasn't reading or having tea or doing anything else. He was just sitting and staring straight at me.
"Why don't you come talk to me?"
he said in his soft voice. It wasn't a question. I had never heard him yell, and at family functions, he was always very quiet. But when he spoke, it was with an air of command. He was one of the most powerful mages in the world, one of the richest men in the world. Granduncle George Findlay didn't have to tell anyone that. You felt it when in his presence. He wasn't physically imposing. His short and slender figure, his hair and closely trimmed beard salted with gray, his sharp cheekbones, Roman nose, and his piercing gray eyes were what you noticed. He was 150 years old, the second generation of Magickers. His parents were the offspring of crippled survivors of a pandemic that killed 4 out of 5 people infected. I walked over and sat in the chair he indicated, and he studied me. The silence stretched, and I tried not to fidget or squirm. Finally, he said,
"Your father would be very proud of you. It's too bad Hunter didn't live to know you. You've grown into a woman who embodies every principle he held dear."
He reached into the pocket of his tweed jacket and pulled out a silver flask. He popped the stopper, took a swig, and passed it to me.
"I'm not supposed to have any fun anymore. No whiskey, no fast women," he chuckled, "although your Aunt Denise has always been fast enough for me. No cigars, no pot, no strenuous exercise. Take a drink."
I did as he ordered. The whiskey was smooth as silk and burned all the way down. I passed the flask back to him. He stoppered it and put it back in his pocket.
"There," he said, "you're a co-conspirator. Now, tell me the truth and don't sugarcoat it. What in the hell is going on with my family?"
"You mean the Moncriefs?" I asked.
"That, of course. Someone tried to kill Olivia, and someone tried to kill you. Now, I understand that a policewoman encounters dangerous situations and probably makes enemies, but an ambush at her home by a pack of rogue mages doesn't sound like an everyday affair. Spill."
"I don't really have any concrete proof." I started, but he cut me off.
"Don't bullshit me, Danny. You're a terrible liar and always have been. You're damned good at your job, and that fiasco out at David and Courtney's place proves it. Human trafficking. Dancing with demons. Courting Akiyama. All of it, now."
So I told him. It took a while, and I concluded with the interview I had just had with Carolyn. He didn't interrupt or ask any questions. The only response I could see was an occasional twitch and his eyes dilating a little. I understood why his business rivals and partners considered him a fearsome negotiator. We sat for a few minutes in silence. Then he said,
"Damn, that girl has always been a problem. She thinks she's a lot smarter than she is. You know she's powerful, right? A strong storm mage."
I assumed he meant his daughter Courtney. I nodded.
"Power without consideration, strength without compassion, has led to many a downfall," he said. "The difference between you and Hunter is that you have some common sense. Your father was the strongest Magitek of his generation, but he didn't match either Hunter or you. And unfortunately, he felt the need to carry Hunter's guilt. What your grandfather did is not your fault. Clear all of that kind of crap thinking out of your head, girl. You don't have to atone for his foolishness. Just use your brain and don't invent your own brand of stupidity. Never forget, we're dangerous. The Magi are dangerous to humanity, to the planet, to ourselves."
He sighed and leaned back in his chair.
"Thank you. You've given me a lot to think about. I'm not really sure what to do about my daughter. I'll talk to her mother. But Denise has always been the weaker person in that relationship."
He chuckled softly.
"Hell, that's probably the pot calling the kettle."
"Is that all, sir?" I asked.
"One more thing. If you get a chance to talk to David, try to find out what in the hell they're all thinking. I can't imagine that his brother Alan was willing to toss everything their family has built just to save a few dollars on servants' wages."
It was a long drive out to the Moncrief State on the Elk Neck Peninsula. But compared to the distance from police headquarters, I was already halfway there. I collected my bike and rode out to interview David Moncrief. Normally, showing up unannounced at any Magi family residence and demanding to speak with the head of the house would be considered rude. But since David was under house arrest, I didn't worry about it. I stopped and had a late lunch at a little crab shack overlooking the bay. Michael had taken David's statement when he was first arrested. I called the file up on my laptop and read it while I ate. The Moncrief family was headquartered in Scotland. After the pandemic, the Moncrief survived.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?